welcome to Podcast Ed, the podcast of reimaginedonline.org, covering the stories in the new world of public education. On this episode, Step Up for Students President Doug Tuthill talks with Alexis LaRoe, Step Up's Manager of Legislative Affairs. With the 2022 Florida legislative session now wrapped up, featuring the largest education budget in the history of the state, the two discuss changes to the education choice programs that passed this year. They also discuss the heated debate this year over parental rights in education, how public education has always played a role in social engineering, and how the expansion of education choice will impact all of those things. Thank you for listening and enjoy the episode.
So today I'm excited to have Alexis LaRoe with us. Alexis is the manager of legislative affairs at Step Up for Students, and she is our face in Tallahassee. The legislative session ended on Monday of this week, and so we're going to just review all the wonderful things that happened for education choice and for education in general in the state of Florida. So Alexis, welcome to Reimagined Podcast.
Thank you, Doug. I've never obviously been on a podcast before. I've always just been a listener, so this is kind of exciting. Thanks for having me.
Well, there's always a first for everything, right?
Yeah, yep.
So let's start with the budget, because it's a fairly historic budget, obviously the largest education budget in the history of Florida. Can you just give an overview of the budget, and particularly how that relates to the scholarship amount that kids will receive through Step Up?
Yeah, of course. So I think this year was a really good year for education when it comes to funding. And I mean, all education, including public education, they really funded public education in tremendous ways. So I think mostly as it relates to our scholarship dollars, the unweighted FTE is set to increase by 2.42%. over last year's amount. So we should see a boost in our scholarship amounts. And especially with the funds per weights for per pupil, that's also set to increase by $384. So that's exciting for us. They also funded the base student allocation with an additional $214. And they also, when it comes to public education in general, they allocated $250 million to the school districts for them to disperse for teacher salary raises for veterans and new teachers. So I think public education was really tremendously funded this session for everybody.
And so since our scholarship amount is pegged to how much money the state spends for kids in district schools, our scholarships will probably go up at least a couple hundred dollars. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I would say that too. We'll know for sure this summer, but I think something is something we can get excited about going forward.
Yeah, that's exciting news. So let's drill down about some of the more specific issues that happened during the session. As some of our listeners may know, we had a real train wreck last fall with something called the cross check, which is a situation where Step Up determines whether a family is eligible for the scholarship. And then once they're eligible, we send their name over to the Department of Education. They have to check with the school districts to make sure that the child is not enrolled in a school district, because obviously you don't want the child enrolled in a school district while simultaneously receiving scholarship funds. It has to be one or the other. And I think last fall we had over 8,000 children misidentified as attending a district school when they really weren't. And once they get misidentified like that, the state's not allowed to give us any money for the kids, because obviously the data shows that they're enrolled in a district school, even though they're not. So it took us all fall to clean that up. So a lot of families didn't get their money until late November, sometimes even in December. And so this was a number one priority issue for us, to try to fix that problem so that children were being misidentified in August and September, and then therefore not receiving any funds until we could clarify the situation, which oftentimes takes months. So tell us what happened with the cross-check issue.
Yeah, this was definitely, we went into session, this is our number one thing we wanted to fix for our families and our schools. So right now, the Florida Tax Credit and the HOPE students, well, they get cross-checked twice a year, and the Family Empowerment students are getting cross-checked four times a year. So what we did was we created language that would align the Florida Family Empowerment students with the Florida Tax Credit and HOPE. So now the Family Empowerment students will be getting cross-checked twice a year, like the Florida Tax Credit and the HOPE. And so we really think this is going to allow students and schools to get their money earlier in the year and not have to be worried about a delay in funding, especially our schools. as they are waiting to pay their staff and everything at the beginning of this end of the summer, beginning of the school year. So we think that allowing these family empowerment students to be cross-checked the same way as tax credit and HOPE, it'll just, you know, get rid of a lot of the problems that we saw this past year.
So we'll be able to fund those children in the fall right away and not have to wait for this DOE to check with the school district to see if they're enrolled or not. And if later in the school year we find that there's a problem, we have some time to clean that up. And so families are still getting funding. They're still funding the school. So again, that will allow us to clean up any problems, but we don't have to wait for the funding to happen in order for those kids to get enrolled. So that's going to be a big win. So let's go to the other. We had another big priority this session, which was the wait list for the children on our FES Unique Abilities Scholarship. For our listeners, just remember that these are kids with sort of deep in, we call them unique abilities or special needs, spina bifida, Down syndrome, autism. That program every year has been oversubscribed, that we always have had a waiting list, and we fought to get that waiting list down. This year, I think we ended up with over 5,000 kids on the wait list. So Alexis, tell us what the state legislature tried to do to help us ameliorate that wait list moving forward.
Yeah, so this was, again, another big item for us. Currently in legislation, the program is capped at 20,000 students annually, and then it can increase that 1% of the exceptional student allocation minus gifted. So that's been estimated to be like 4,500 students of an annual increase every year. So this year, for this coming 22-23, the legislator has already allocated fund for the 4,500 students that were supposed to be added this year. So that was already going to be, those kids were already going to be included in the program. But what they ended up going into the language and changing was the cap that was at 20,000, they changed it to 26,500 students cap for the program. So that not only allows the 4,500 students that were already set to enroll, but it also gives funding for an additional 2,000 students on top of that. So we're looking at hopefully being able to serve around 6,500 students off the wait list between us and other scholarship funding organizations this year. So that's really exciting for us. Like you said, there's always been a huge demand for that program, and we're just trying to keep up with that.
Yeah, so with 5,000 kids on the wait list, those children by law have top priority. So if we hadn't had this increase in the cap, had the cap only increased 4,500, you literally would have had about 500 kids on a wait list for a second year. And obviously no new kids could come on board. So if you go up to 26,500, hopefully that takes care of the current wait list and allows us to add 1,500 new kids. We'll probably still end up with a wait list, but it certainly is progress. And hopefully in future years, we'll continue to move forward. Eventually, you would like to see every child qualifies to be able to get a scholarship. You don't want to see any child with Down syndrome or spina bifida or autism, any of those children. You don't want to see those children not being able to get the services they need. So hopefully someday we'll get rid of the wait list totally. And I think this is a huge step forward.
Yeah.
So let's also talk about the reading program. We've had a reading scholarship for a couple years now. It's also an educational savings account, just like our family empowerment scholarships for unique abilities kids. Talk about the changes that the legislature made to the reading scholarship program.
Yeah, so just for a quick little background. So last year, Speaker Sprouse created this new program called the New World Reading Initiative. And what he wanted to do with this program was be able to deliver books to students' homes in Florida who are reading below the grade level. So I think yesterday I saw a tweet that they have served over 100,000 students in 4 months. So there's a lot of students on that program. So what they did with our reading program was they renamed it to be the New World Reading Scholarship Program. So now our reading program is falling under the umbrella of the New World Reading Initiative. And basically we're kind of serving now the same population because they also expanded the program to include students in K-5, which is the same as New World Reading Initiative. Students that have a substantial reading deficiency, I'll add. And then it's also going to allow the public school teachers to tutor on their campus after school hours, which I think will be great and hopefully will increase usability because these students or these teachers could have a second stream of income by offering to help students as they have time after school and not have to really relocate anywhere. They can just do it in their classroom or something. So we're really excited about that. And we're hoping that it's going to drive some more applications and more use of the program. I think it'll be great.
And hopefully there's some synergy between the the scholarship program, which families can use for tutors and other kinds of reading support, like you said, working with a teacher after school, and also the book distribution. So the more that we can integrate these various literacy programs and have them operate as a seamless system, the better. So I think this is a real step forward in terms of reducing bureaucracy and streamlining the program and hopefully creating some complementary services. So I think it's a really good move. And obviously this is the literacy initiative in Florida has been going on for a long, long time. And this is continuing to make that a high priority for us in the state. So let's talk about transportation. We do have a transportation scholarship that we use in Step Up so that families can get a transportation scholarship to go from one school district to the next. Talk some about how they tweak that program, Alexis.
Yeah, this was really unexpected for us, honestly. The transportation scholarship has been underutilized, but this year we've been able to reach out to students in charter schools and get more people on the transportation scholarship. So the legislature this year, they decided to make the transportation scholarship amount, it can either be $750, or if that student's school district funds their per student riding a school bus at higher than $750, that student can receive the higher amount. So $750 or the higher amount, and that'll go towards their transportation scholarship. Another interesting thing is it's going to allow scholarship funding organizations to use their funds to create a rideshare program or a carpooling program. And this is also the case for public schools. So the DOE has a rideshare grant, and these school districts can sign up to receive this grant money, and they have to show their proposal on how they're going to market their rideshare and what they're going to do. And they can get selected for this grant, and then the school district can use that money to pick up students. I mean, as we know, there is a shortage of bus drivers right now, and school districts are trying to do really anything to help get these students to school. And so I think this is just another attempt to try to help bridge that gap that we're seeing.
Yeah, really, I think this is something we learned from Arizona. Arizona has been really creative in the last year or two in maximizing transportation options. You know, as kids move into a much more customized public education system, oftentimes kids aren't necessarily attending a brick and mortar school all day at that same location. So you're seeing kids move around. They might take a dual enrollment course at the local community college. They may take some courses at a local neighborhood school, but also maybe move across town to a charter school. So you're seeing all kinds of innovation. It may be a micro school that is affiliated with two different schools. And the kids are going from one location to another during the day. So you're seeing a lot of thinking about, as public education becomes way more diverse and way more inclusive in terms of the providers, how do you provide transportation so that kids can move around? I suspect virtual reality be a part of this too, because you know that allows you to move from one location to another without physically actually going there. But nonetheless, I think Arizona has been pioneering some real outside the box thinking about transportation. I think that what you're seeing here is Florida, as we often do, stealing from Arizona and starting to experiment with those ideas. So talk about the expansion of eligibility for some of our programs. I know that the legislature extended eligibility to the children of law enforcement officers. So talk some about that, Alexis.
Yeah, that was a very pleasant surprise for us to see when we saw HB3 come out. And this is really just a law enforcement bill to attract and retain law enforcement in Florida. This was a speaker priority and the governor priority. So we were reading through it, and it said dependents of law enforcement officers can be automatically eligible for Family Empowerment Scholarship educational options, so the income-based version of the Family Empowerment Scholarship. And then it can also be excluded from the Family Empowerment Scholarship cap for EO and then also UA if they're eligible with a disability. So this was something really exciting for us. And I know when they were presenting the bill, they always called it as we also included some family friendly initiatives in this bill. And that was one of them. And they also included like some funds for a scholarship for a law enforcement officer. If they wanted to adopt a student with special needs, they could get like $25,000, I think, for that adoption. And then obviously we serve a special needs population, so they could eventually enroll into the Unique Abilities Program if they wanted to. But I think it opens a lot of doors for us, and it's just continuing to allow more families access to their education options.
Yeah, it's interesting. We have Our income-based program has a cap, the Family Empowerment Scholarship, that's directly state-funded. It has a cap, but there are so many categories of kids that don't count toward the cap that the cap in that program is pretty much irrelevant. The cap with the Unique Abilities Program, which we've mentioned before, that is relevant right now because, like I said, we do have a waiting list. But it'll be interesting to see if they keep carving out exemptions, that cap may eventually become irrelevant too. So I think the caps are eventually going to fade away as they become irrelevant because of all of these abilities to get into the program without counting toward the cap.
Yeah. Yep.
So there was a lot of dialogue about dual enrollment this session. Dual enrollment has been a challenge for us for a couple years, figuring out how to fund it. You know, there's all these complexities. So talk about the discussion around dual enrollment and how that basically played itself out.
Yeah, so last year the legislature created a program called the Dual Enrollment Scholarship Program, and this was to allow private school students to participate in dual enrollment courses without the student or the school having to front the cost of those courses, similar to how a public school student does not have to pay for that. So last year that legislature allocated $15.5 million to the program, and so then this year, obviously our partner organizations wanted to see that program continue to get funded. The Senate had proposed some language that would prohibit students from taking courses during normal school hours. So if they were to do that, the school would have to pay for those courses. So our partner organizations really thought this was gonna prohibit private school students from taking dual enrollment courses because a lot of students work after school. They have sports, they have stuff to do after school. So if they can't take their courses during school hours, they're kind of in a bend. They're choosing what to do, what they can't do. So the House never ended up taking up this language, which I know that we were happy about. A lot of our partner organizations were super happy about that. And they actually ended up funding the program at $18.05 million this year. So they got an increase in funding, and they also didn't have to worry about that prohibiting language that was kind of scaring people.
So are there any other issues that you thought were really significant this session that might have impacted education choice?
Well, I think that we're seeing in the public education sphere, we're seeing more of an emphasis on parental rights in education. And I think that really speaks to education choice because it's the parent's right to choose what's best for their child. So as we see that narrative start to get reflected into public education, we're seeing some pushback saying, you know, like, if you don't like what's going on in your public school, that's why we have choice. Go get a choice scholarship and go to your whatever school you want to send your kid to. I think it's an interesting narrative that's starting to form as leadership continues to push this idea of parental rights, and then they're trying to incorporate that into public school. I think that was probably interesting. It did not have anything to do with us this year. I was really focused on what was getting taught in public schools, but I think it can easily be reflected onto the whole school choice movement and what we stand for.
Yeah, there's some interesting historical context. Public education historically has had a social engineering role. And that sounds negative, but it really means that the society wants to promote certain values, certain ways of thinking, and they use a public education system to do that. So I think the debate is really what that social engineering is going to look like, how prevalent it's going to be, and how much control parents have over that. And I do think what you're going to see is this debate continue for a while. And a lot of the symbolism that you saw in some of the debates really was about, how much social engineering is the government really going to do, and what's that going to look like? Like I said, it has a long history. I'll divert a little bit in history. I mean, the first public school attendance law was passed in 1852 in Massachusetts, and it was passed because the Protestants who controlled Massachusetts were alarmed about the influx of too many Catholics. And so they wanted to make sure that the Catholic families that were moving into Massachusetts learned how to be good Protestants. And so, that was a really good example of, okay, we're going to use a mandatory school attendance to accomplish a social agenda. You know, we want to make sure that all these Catholics become Protestants. And probably the most exaggerated example of this happened in 1922 in Oregon, when a group led by the Ku Klux Klan, got a constitutional amendment passed in Oregon requiring, making it against the law for anybody not to attend a district school. And again, they were really targeting Catholics and Jews and trying to make sure that those families, their children would turn into be Protestants and not allowed to continue to be Catholic and Jews. The U.S. Supreme Court overturned that decision in 1925 and said, no, you know, you have the right to be educated in a school other than a government school. But that theme has continued. And when I was a kid growing up, I'm a million times older than you, Alexis, but I was raised in segregated schools. And again, that was to accomplish a social end. You know, it was a segregated society, and the society wanted to use, the government wanted to use education, public education, as a way to perpetuate racial segregation. And then, you know, when I was in high school, the government changed its mind and decided that it was going to use the public schools as a way to promote society-wide racial integration. And so again, and you can see it every year in legislature, you know, they'll pass a law saying we want to teach kids how to ride bicycles. We want to teach them how to brush their teeth. We want to teach them this and this and this. We want to teach Americanism versus communism, which was a course I had to take in high school. So there's a long history of using public schools as an instrument of social engineering. And then you have diverse political factions arguing back and forth what that should look like. And that's basically what you're seeing today in the legislature. Again, it has a long 170-year history. But I do think the education choice movement is going to impact that, like you said. I think what you'll see is way more flexibility for families to say, you know, I want to opt out of a sort of a heavy indoctrination piece, and I want to put my child in an environment that more reflects my values. I do think that there'll still be an attempt to have common values. It's just a question of how far do you go, and that's the debate we're having. So I suspect it'll never end. But for our listeners, don't think this is a new thing. This has been going on forever. And so it'll continue to go on. But like I said, I think some of the tension might be dissipated when families have more choices. I think that might alleviate some of the tension about, you know, how exactly are we going to teach human sexuality in our school? You know, is it going to be a one-size-fits-all approach, or are families going to have options? So I think you're going to see that unfold moving forward.
Yeah, I feel like when I talk to a lot of families, at least for me, growing up in Vermont, you went to private school because it was, first of all, there weren't many private schools, but you went there for a better education. Like, it was just supposed to be more Catholic-based, whatever. But our public schools were also really great. And so when I came to Florida and I started talking to our scholarship families, and I thought it was because they wanted more better academics. But honestly, when you talk to them, they really just want something that is going to teach their kids what they would teach their kids at home. Like, they just want a community that reflects their faith or their belief system. And that totally made me think about private schools totally different, because I was always mindset of, oh, they want to just be so great and go to college and go to university. I mean, like, I'm sure that is the case for some people, but a lot of our families that we serve, they just want that like environment and community feeling from their school.
Yeah, it is interesting how many families are making a values decision. Mm-hmm. They care about academics, but they really care about safety, which oftentimes isn't just physical, it's also emotional. You know, they want emotional safety. They oftentimes want their kid in a cultural environment that's very consistent with the home cultural environment. And so, again, that's what you're seeing played out in the legislature with these contentious issues, is how much power are we going to give families to educate their children in an environment that's consistent with their home values? But at the same time, there's obviously some common values we want everybody to be able to assimilate, you know, understanding the Constitution, understanding, you know, the Bill of Rights, why the First Amendment's important, et cetera, et cetera. So, again, that was a big issue in our legislative session. It sort of dominated the session in one sense. But like I said, it's an issue that's been going on for 170 years, and it'll probably continue in the future. But I do think the Ed Choice movement is going to have some impact on hopefully taking the temperature down a little bit, as families have more options and feel less coerced in terms of how their kids are being educated.